Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is David Figura. He's the outdoors writer for the Syracuse Post-Standard and Syracuse.com. He's also the author of a book about men dealing with middle age titled, So What Are the Guys Doing? David, welcome to the program.
Hello. Glad to be here.
We'll talk about the book later in the broadcast, but first let's cover some public affairs issues related to the outdoors in central New York. Could you give me a sense of the general health of the environment and wildlife in the central New York region in recent years? How have we been doing?
I say this repeatedly in my column and online. We are living in a hunting and fishing nirvana here. Fishing and hunting is multi-million dollar industries in this state, and we are sitting right in some extremely prime areas for fishing and hunting. And I think that's one of the reasons I have a job, because there's so much interest in that.
Have there been any particular species that have been great success stories here in the region, or on the other hand, have there been particular challenges for some species here?
Well, success stories, I mean, statewide, the comeback of the bald eagle is just unbelievable. And I guess every time I see one fly over my head when I'm driving down 690 from Onondaga Lake, I just have to pause and just admire it. That's been a real success story. Trying to think what other success stories there are. That's one of the biggest ones. One of the most troubling things was the appearance of more than a decade ago of the Russian wild boar on the scene of around Spafford. And, you know, basically these animals escaped from a canned hunting facility around the Spafford area and spread. And the whole idea of 350 to 400, almost 500-pound Russian wild boar running around was a kind of a daunting thing. The EC was quite worked up about it. And finally, U.S. Wildlife officials from the Agriculture Department came in and started, with the help of landowners, corral trapping them and hunting them over bait. And you haven't heard of these things for the past couple of years. It's been a success story.
Was that related to I've read about a similar problem in Texas that has gotten quite extreme. Is this the same kind of animal, do you know?
Or yes.
Is this,
okay. I mean, it's not exactly the same, but the whole idea is it's a wild or feral hog, and they reproduce like crazy. They're very, they're resilient and hard to stop once they explode population-wise, and that's why everyone was so concerned. They didn't want to see this new animal on the scene here, ripping up our habitat and affecting all sorts of other wildlife.
And I have heard the Syracuse mayor say that she gets more calls about deer than anything else. What is the situation with deer in the urban area here in the Syracuse region?
I have written extensively about this and will continue to write about this. Particularly the eastern half of the city and some of the surrounding towns like DeWitt, there's a lot of deer there, and more than one would expect. There's been studies done. One recently concluded that there was an average of 15 deer per square mile in some areas, as many as 40, 50 in an area, in certain concentration areas like St. Mary's Cemetery and right here around Syracuse University campus, there's a lot of deer. And what's interesting is that the city has formed committees, and there's been no real plan announced of what they're going to do.
What are the options to deal with this? I mean,
There's a spectrum,
yeah.
And the spectrum is what the citizenry is willing to tolerate. On the one end, you have people who don't want anything that involves lethal means, and they're willing to pay to have them sterilized. And on the other hand, you have, just bring in some bow hunters, bait them, and shoot them. And an example of a municipality that recently did that was Trumansburg, that passed a legislation allowing the firing of bow and arrows within the municipality, and they took out 81 deer in a matter of about 2 months, and they've since upped the amount that they want to take to 100. And at little cost to the municipality, and all the meat was donated to a local food pantry.
What is the problem with having that kind of concentration of deer? Is it danger on the roads? Is it that people don't like getting their rhododendrons eaten? What is exactly the issue?
There's three issues here and three reasons that from a public policy standpoint that the city of Syracuse should take some action. One is deer motor vehicle accidents. Two is, of course, all people's shrubbery and plants is ecological impacts by having all those deer in the city. And third, I feel what the most important issue is that the spread of Lyme disease. Mm. There is a noticeable uptick in Lyme disease in this area. And I keep hearing that. I keep hearing anecdotally that that's happening and statistically from the Department of Health. And I think that needs to be recognized.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with David Figura, the outdoors writer for the Syracuse Post-Standard and Syracuse.com. The state of New York is generally known as a highly regulatory one relative to other states, and I was wondering whether that was true for wildlife and environmental conservation as well.
Well, there's a lot of rules and regs that the DEC has put in place, and since getting on this beat, I realize they're there for a reason. And I'm not an expert on comparing our rules and regs versus other states, but I think in general, New York State is highly regulated, and the same goes for its hunting and fishing.
And do you encounter in talking to folks a similar set of arguments that you often hear against the regulatory state in New York, you know, that businesses and industries that might be related to sportsmen's activities are not going to locate here, or other businesses might get lost? Do you get that pushback when you're talking to folks?
I mean, what I'm hearing is that I don't look upon it the same way like industry coming in. I mean, basically the hunting and fishing is here. Mm. And regulation is, I guess I've come to realize since being on this beat, there's reasons behind things. And the number, somebody summed it up the other day there when we were talking about, you know, limits for how many walleye you could catch and how big they have to be. Some people complained, you know, and he came up with this, you know, the idea is not to drive these fish or animals to extinction.
Right.
That's not the reason we're out here. And I agree with that. And so I think there is a real need for rules and regulations. And like I said, in fishing and hunting. And I think most sportsmen appreciate and understand that.
Well, you must also hear a lot about the SAFE Act and your beat. And I wanted to ask you a couple questions about that. The life for sports persons post SAFE Act, it passed a little over 2 years ago now, so yep. We've been living with it. How much impact has it had on the pursuit of the sportsman's interests, do you think?
I'm not seeing that big of an impact in the people I've been talking to on the hunting scene. I guess what I've been hearing is that, you know, there's more of a concern about, you know, sportsmen's rights, people's constitutional rights as far as the right to bear arms. And I think pretty much what's happened is there's pretty much a consensus or I guess a resignation that the SAFE Act's here to stay. But what sportsmen and lawmakers who are sympathizing with these sportsmen are trying to do right now is to take aspects of the SAFE Act and challenge it, such as the, you know, how many rounds you can have in your clip if you have like a semi-automatic firearm, or the whole ammunition background check thing is still like seems like miles or years away because the amount of money it's going to take to put it into place. And the state police keep saying, you know, we haven't got this together. This is 2 years afterwards. The state police is saying we still haven't got this together. And there's also concern from mental health officials about, well, geez, if I'm dealing with a client and I suspect that they may be harmful to themselves and others and they own a gun, do I turn them in?
Mm-hmm.
And if I do that, do I violate their confidentiality of, you know, dealing with them? But if I don't and they go out and do something, am I going to be prosecuted for it? And that's a real concern to mental health officials I've talked to. And this isn't sportsmen, but that's what they're dealing with. And
well, you mentioned the background check for ammunition sales. That was one of the provisions that that did get a lot of attention. And as you say, it hasn't come online yet. But the idea was that in addition to firearm sales being subject to these background checks, the same background check would be given when someone buys a box of ammunition. What is the problem with making this happen?
I guess it's from a standpoint of administratively, it's extremely expensive and extremely difficult from the state police standpoint to do this. And what a lot of people don't realize is I go in and buy just 6 shotgun shells for the hunting season. They're going to do a background check on me. But I can't loan my ammunition out in the field if you don't have any ammunition. You suddenly forgot your shells at home. And once again, you got to carry receipts around that you actually bought this ammunition. Mm-hmm. And then you have all these target shooters who are going through like rounds and rounds of 22s, shooting in competitive 22 leagues or trap shooting leagues. And it's just, I think, administratively very difficult to pull off. And the state is fighting that out.
You mentioned the 22 ammunition. This is a more, as I understand it, a more national issue with the availability of 22 ammunition. This is the most popular cartridge by far for recreational shooting and for small game hunting. What's going on there? Why is this so hard to find?
You go to these gun shows and, you know, whether you agree with it or not, you see these signs, you know, our best salesman, and they show a picture of President Obama or Andrew Cuomo. I think there's a feeling that this ammunition may be taken away from us, so we better buy it now before it gets taken away and stockpile. And that's what's happening.
So it's hoarding.
It's hoarding. People are. They are.
Okay. Okay.
And they go to these gun shows, and they're paying over, you know, more than they probably normally would pay to make sure they have it. And, you know, the sad thing about it is, no one's taking it away from them, but they're continuing to buy. Like, you look at the ammunition sales in this country, firearm sales, they're skyrocketing. They're going up and continue to go up.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with David Figuera. He's the outdoors writer for the Syracuse Post-Standard and Syracuse.com, and he's the author of the new book, So What Are the Guys Doing? Well, we have had an extremely cold winter and now spring, it seems. March it seems worse than February, at least relative to what we would be expecting for March. So what has been and will be the impact of that on wildlife here?
What I'm seeing in my own backyard on the way to work and what I'm hearing anecdotally from people is that this snow cover, an extended stretch of cold, is affecting wildlife. What I found really interesting is I talked to an animal rehabilitator the other day, and she's getting a lot of owls that are being brought to her, red-tailed hawks, animals like that rely on you see the red-tailed hawks, and they're looking at the snow, and they're thinking, okay, they're waiting for the mice to go scurrying across or the rabbits. And everyone's staying, hunkering down under the snow, and it's really been rough on them. And deer are, they can survive on arborvitae. And so they're going into residential areas more so. I've had a deer eating off my neighbor's shrubs just yesterday. I couldn't believe how close it came to our house.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, food's scarce when everything is covered with snow and ice. And usually this time of year, buds are coming out. And I think wildlife is taking a hit right now. I mean, I thought if this was going to be gone by the end of this month, things would be okay. But I think you're going to see more cases of the weak and the starving deer falling and other animals that just aren't strong enough to make it through the winter. It's been tough on them.
Well, trout season is literally just around the corner. How's that shaping up, and how will this winter affect that?
Well, what's interesting is that, like I was telling you before we started here, I'm still ice fishing. I was out ice fishing this weekend, 12 inches of ice on Owasco Lake. And basically, people are getting ready to go trout fishing in a week. The county, which stocks Onondaga County, which stocks the streams and some waterways in the Onondaga County, they've been out this week. And I talked to the hatchery recently. They're pouring fish in, getting ready for opening day. And I think the state has delayed probably a little bit of stocking their streams south of here. But what's happening is you're going to have an opening day where most likely there will be – the trout are going to be okay. That's the one thing that people keep – the trout – yes, the trout are – they've survived cold and stuff like this for thousands and thousands of years. But for the anglers, I think they better be prepared to have snow on the banks of the streams that they're fishing. It's probably going to be a cold, chilly opening morning and fish low and slow. And and one of the things that I think is going to be impacted is the Finger Lake tributaries, where usually the biggest trout come in, like Grout Brook and Cougar Lake Inlet and Catherine's Creek. The whole spawning of the rainbow trout is depending on the water temperature and the amount of daylight. So they're going to be coming up, but I don't think they're going to be quite ready to spawn yet. So I think there's not going to be as many fish. There'll be fish in those Finger Lake tribs, and that's usually where the biggest fish are caught on the inland trout waters every year. But I don't think it's going to be that great of an opening day for the inland tribs, and I think that those rainbows will be spawning a little bit later into April, and they'll be there for a while.
What's your most memorable experience so far in the field since you've been the outdoors writer?
I've had a lot of really interesting and fun experiences, but I just go back to – I teamed up with Chris Wagner, the golf writer, and Rory Williams, an editor from the sports desk, and we hit like four golf courses. And we've gotten golf courts and got our bass fishing equipment, and we fished their ponds. And I think the highlight of that day was catching a 21-inch largemouth on one pond right in front of a par three, and having the guys yell at me, like, what was I doing there? And I put my hand up, and I was fighting this fish. And they got the idea when I held up this huge largemouth.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is the outdoors writer, David Figuera. Well, let's talk about your book. So what are the guys doing? Why did you write this?
I was going through a bad time when I turned 50. Bad time in my marriage, burned out in my career, pretty much a workaholic, feeling like I didn't have any friends. And I started making some changes, and then I started reading up on what other people have been writing about men in midlife, and I realized that I wasn't alone. And then I started interviewing guys, and it took me 9 years to write this book, but I interviewed 50 guys between the ages of 40 and 60, and everything from sex, friendship, loneliness, the younger woman thing, and what I call the middle-aged boogeyman, which is fear of taking a risk in your career at midlife, or even worse yet, fear of being laid off.
Mm. And that's a big fear for people increasingly in the post-Great Recession economy.
Sure is. And I mentioned that a lot of guys smile, but everyone seems to know someone who's been laid off lately or is in fear of being laid off. And it's a real presence there.
And so how did you go about you say you did these interviews? What other things did you base the book on? Is it a blend of your personal memoir and what you're getting from other people you're talking to? How'd you set it up that way?
The string that goes through the entire book is my story. And actually, some of the changes I made in my life to focus on, you know, to change those three areas I talked about earlier, some of the changes I made were actually prompted by what other guys told me.
Huh.
And so I came up with the idea is this is not like a scientific study. This is just me telling what I went through and what the other guys said when I talked to them. And my promise to anyone who reads this book, particularly men, is that they're going to say, wow, that's me. Or two, boy, I feel sorry for that poor guy. Or three, you know, that's really inspiring. Maybe I should make a change in my life. And I think that's one thing that men need to know, that in midlife, you have to embrace change. And that, I feel, is a key to being happy.
Well, it sounds like you are more satisfied with the person now that you are than when you started into this process, clearly. So what do you like better about yourself now than where you were when you were 50?
Well, I didn't have the affair that I wrote about.
Okay.
I've been happily married for 34 years, and I'm more in love with my wife than ever. I have a job because I took a risk and became the outdoors writer, and I'm extremely happy with it, extremely happy. I get up every morning. I love going to work. I love doing what I'm doing. And three, I formed a low-stakes poker group, co-ed volleyball team, and I helped form a summer horseshoe throwing league where we go out and have beer afterwards on Thursday nights. And I guess if I could sum it up, you know, as far as the friends thing, is that good friends do make for a good life. And a lot of guys need to think about that and act upon it. And one of the points I do make in the book is I feel a lot of women do get it. And for that reason, I think a lot of women, not all, but a lot of women are handling the midlife years better than guys because they realize the importance of living a balanced life.
And is that the essential message then from an advice kind of perspective then? It's about, is it friends? Is it the embrace of change?
Both.
Both.
Both. And like I said, I didn't want to come off as, you know, 10 ways to make your life better. Mm-hmm. You know, it's basically, you read it and you say, well, that's what this guy went through. And you look at your own self and do a little introspection and say, maybe I need to do something or not. I leave it up to you. I don't pontificate and say there's only one way.
And the book's available on Amazon, I assume?
Yes, in Barnes & Noble and DeWitt here and several independent bookstores in the area.
Let me get to the three questions first. What's the title of the chapter of life you're currently living?
I'd say latter middle age.
Second, what's your worst trait?
I talk too much, and sometimes I'm too disorganized for my wife's satisfaction.
And finally, what achievement in your professional or creative life so far has surprised you the most?
I think doing the outdoors beat was huge because I've been in journalism for 33 years, and it's been really fun. But I go back to the fact that writing and getting this book published was a big accomplishment for me.
That was David Figura. His new book, again, is called So What Are the Guys Doing? David, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, edited by Jason Smith, with research assistance provided by Elizabeth Boyd. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.